Hello, I'm Alexis Petridis, and this is Music Weekly from The Guardian. Coming up, New York rock producer David Sitek tells us how landscaping was his first love and what inspired his first solo album, Maximum Bloom.
To make a song about Bernie Madoff would be hilarious, you know, for like maybe a month. But I just tried to stick with the major themes, you know. Two turntables, a microphone, and a grill.
Singles Club this week features CeeLo Green, Grinder Man, and Autre Neveu. And we also mark the return of your label, Sherry. We'll be hearing from Nadia Dilawi and Sarah J, the indie impresarios behind record label and club night Young and Lost.
The single sold out in about a month, but it was about 3 months late because we used this pressing plant in Czechoslovakia and they didn't speak English. But it was the cheapest place we could find.
That's all in Music Weekly. I'm joined, as ever, by Rosie Swash. Hello, Rosie.
Hello.
What's been going on? I know what's been going on. You've been following, as we all have, I'm sure,
the
Twitter feed of 50 Cent.
Well, it's not just him. I mean, I've been looking at the English 50 Cent, which is a little old now, but that's very funny. But then Max Tundra, the musician, has been declared psychological warfare on 50 Cent is just responding
wow.
to every single one of his tweets.
you heard it here first, people. Max Tundra has declared psychological warfare. I'm just going to bring in another guest here. Tim Jones, have you been following Max Tundra's psychological warfare?
I have. It's like Biggie Tupac all over.
It is. Yeah, exactly. I hope there's no blood spilled. What's he been saying?
Imagine if 50 Cent did a drive-by on Max Tundra. Fantastic.
No, don't say that. one of them was, you wouldn't happen to know the multi-region hack for the Argos Value Range DS36A DVD player, would you? To 50 Cent. The next one was, confession time. I avoid tea tree based shower gels for the disconcerting cooling effect they have on my privates. Your turn. not once has 50 Cent responded.
Let's move on to something nicer. We're starting this week's podcast with an interview that Rosie recorded with David Sitek. If you didn't know, Dave plays guitar and keyboards for TV on the radio, most recently for the album Dear Science, but he's also a producer. He's worked on records for fellow New Yorkers, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs and the Liars, and now he's got an album out all on his own called Maximum Bloom. It's full of his mates performing vocal duties. His mates being whom, Rosie?
Various members of TV on the radio do appear on there, which is a little confusing. What's his name? Theophilus London, another Brooklynite. Karen O.
So it's got David Byrne on it.
It has also got David Byrne on it, yes.
Amazing. We'll be hearing Dave talking to Rosie after a track from the album. This is The Lesson, featuring Holly Miranda.
Somebody like you seems to be doing something musical all the time.
Yeah.
And I wondered whether you came off the back of touring Dear Science. Were you exhausted? Were you bored by music? Like, do you have to take time off from it? Or is it just a constant?
It's a constant thing. I mean, I don't ever... I feel like I have a saying, why mess around when you can fuck around? Which you can edit that out.
Yeah, you can say that.
But, you know, it's like I feel like... You know, doing what you want 1,000% is what you should be doing. Like, if you don't want to do something 1,000%, you should do something else. And so far, music has beat out landscaping, but landscaping's getting up right behind it. You know what I mean? Be outside with a weed whacker for a few hours.
So is that how you balance out the music?
Yeah, it's like if I have any hesitation, I'll just get a weed whacker. That's kind of my backup plan. I would landscape just to date my favorite job.
I wondered why, what spurred the move to LA, other than the landscaping, of course.
Well, you know, I had my fun, you know, I far exceeded my goals. And in my view, the New York that I was into was the New York that was closest to what I was used to, which was Baltimore and, you know, warehouse living, kind of dirty, you know, dirty people having a dirty time. So I was really into, you know, people just like, you know, living on the edge and living on the outskirts and the fringes and stuff. And And economically, it was just kind of goofy there for a while.
In New York?
Yeah, my rent tripled, and I just, you know, most of the music that I like to record is not stuff that has a budget, so it's a lot easier to do that in L.A. You know, there's a lot more affordable studios. It's easier for a band to be out there for a while and spend time.
Did the Maximum Balloon album happen when you got there, or was it an idea that you had for a long time?
No, it happened when I got there. It happened by accident. I don't, you know, much like the rest of my life, there's absolutely no foresight involved. You know, I just kind of was like, oh, I'll just make a song. And then I made a song, and I was like, hey, this actually works out okay. You know, I worked on the song Tiger with Aku, and then I was like, hey, I like this. So then I played it for some other people who were on the record, and I gave them some songs, and they did some stuff. And after like 7 songs, I was like, maybe this is a record, you know? Let's move if you want to, or not.
There was another journalist from The Guardian who you were talking to, and he quotes you as talking about the barbecue aspect and the sound of the record, and you said something like food and sex, you know, as in like that was full stop.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can pontificate and you can, you know, find all these like tangents of things to talk about and things to sing about, but you know, I kind of just returned to the fundamentals, and I was like, you know, pretty much eating, drinking, fucking, and dying. Like, that's it, you know? And you can, I mean, to make a song about Bernie Madoff would be hilarious, you know, for like maybe a month. But I just tried to stick with the major themes, you know? 2 turntables, a microphone, and a grill. Yeah, this record was just more immediate. It was about the dance floor, and I think that that, like, visceral energy, I hang out, you know, with DJs. You know, I make music for people who are like at check cashing places or are losing their jobs or making out or like delivering pizzas or DJs. I don't really make music for, you know, journalism or musicians or anything like that. It's like, you know, to me, when I was landscaping, having like a cassette Walkman and listening to the Sugar Cubes' Life's Too Good over and over and over again had such an impact on me and the world like it took me to. And I try to never lose sight of that. It's about the speakers and the speakers coming to life and how can you like bring someone into some other world.
That was Dave Sitek talking with Rosie. An interesting album, Maximum Balloon. I mean, what do you think about sort of the phenomenon of the producer-curated guest vocalist? It's something that's interesting because you used to get them obviously all the time in dance music because that's the way that dance producers function, is bringing guest vocalists. Kind of a newer thing for, you know, what you might loosely term indie music or rock. Do you think it works?
Well, I do. I like this album, but often why that concept doesn't work for me is that you have this, you know, revolving assembly line of collaborators coming on. So it doesn't even really sound like a solo album.
No, absolutely.
And therefore it lacks a central kind of humanity to it. And it's a bit all over the place. And that, but then this album, as he said in the interview, is, you know, it's... reference point is food and sex. It's all quite sort of base level stuff and is not necessarily an album full of love songs, which might need to come from a central point of humanity. So it works for me, this album, but yeah, you know, I mean, it does make you think these days of, you know, Mark Ronson's kind of approach to nicking a bit of this and nicking a bit of that and calling it his own.
Some people say the template was Gorillaz, don't they?
Yeah, and that was my problem with the Gorillaz last record.
That it was just too guesty and too showing off all the contacts.
Yeah, or it just didn't mean anything to me. As you know, well, there wasn't enough emotion to it.
What about Murdoch? I mean, he was suffering on that album.
He was suffering a bit, isn't it? Wasn't he? Has he got a sort of unifying sound? Do you think David Sitek is that why it?
I do actually. Works, I think even this. I mean.
Because whatever you say, you can knock Mark Ronson, you know, but one of the reasons I think Version as an album, you know, worked is because for all people going, oh, loads of horns in it and all that kind of thing, at least it had a sound that kind of ran through the whole album. So it wasn't like listening to a compilation, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Is that true of Dave Sitek? Does he have kind of a trademark sound?
Because I first listened to the single Groove Me, which I think is probably the best song on the album. before I actually knew he was involved. And straight away I thought, this sounds like TV and the radio, but more a more poppy version. Mm. And so, I mean, that's interesting, just that you can detect it. And it's quite a weird signature sound. I mean, it's like a sci-fi funk thing.
And they do have that element, TV and the radio. It's just a reprisal of that smaller element. And it wasn't so much a part of Dear Science, but it has been in their past.
And even actually on the Holly and Miranda album, you can tell, you probably wouldn't be able to tell just off listening, but you can really hear, once you know, what he's done with the brass parts on that album. You can tell he's a bit of a master of that kind of thing.
It's interesting, there's not many producers working in that area that you can automatically tell. I mean, Dave Fridman, I always think the guy who does Flaming Lips and Mercury Rev and stuff like that. You can tell a mile off when Dave Fridman's produced a record. I suppose to a degree it's also true of...
But then Ben Beaumont Thomas, who was with us last week, and he does a series of events where he has various creative people coming and talking about the creative process, and one of them was Paul Epworth, and Paul Epworth was saying, I try my hardest not to be that presence. Or maybe that was Ian, or was he saying, he was saying it to Ben, that he doesn't want to have...
Yeah, Errol Alkin said something really similar to me. He didn't want to be, you know, he didn't want people to employ him for an Errol Alkin sound, you know. Maximum Balloon by Dave Sitek is out now. Time for Singles Club now. We've each brought in a track to discuss, and this one was chosen by Tim. That was Bossy by Autre Laveau. It's actually a cover of a Lindsay Lohan song and appears on a mixtape from Triangle. That's two words, T-R-I-A-N-G-L. Well, that's how you spell triangle. but, you know, there's a gap in between the try and the angle. Records. The mixtape is called Let Me Shine For You. Tim, you brought that in. Explain yourself, please.
I did. I'm not sure we got the full kind of glory of the track from that. That was kind of the weirdest bit of it, probably. Yeah, so Triangle basically...
Does the rest of it sound like JLS?
Yeah. Well, the rest of it does have, I think, quite a pop sensibility to it. So Triangle are like a Brooklyn label, and they've kind of be... one of the people who set them up is the writer on 20 Jazz Funk Greats. You know,
the blog. Yeah, an excellent blog. Excellent blog, 20 Jazz Funk Greats.
And they've kind of become the home to Witch House, as a lot of them don't like being called, or also Drag, or there's lots of different names for it. But basically, it's bands like... and Balam Akeb, I don't know if I'm saying that right. So basically, there's all these kind of hipster bands
major important bands.
Yeah. but they're kind of...
What brings you on to X Factor? Oh, I'm very heavily influenced by A.
But then what I suppose what's interesting is they are making quite difficult, obscure music, but yet they want to play around with Lindsay Lohan songs. And I think it's interesting that a lot of these bands... You know, they're really inspired by mainstream pop culture. And
are they inspired by it, or is it kind of like you used to get, you know, in the late 80s, the funny cover of a Kylie Minogue song at the end of Appeal Session?
I think there's a lot of affection for it.
Okay.
I think there's genuine affection for it. I think with a lot of bands at the moment, they're taking things from, you know, a lot of these bands, they kind of mix up. There's 90s R&B in there. There's lots of early rave in there. There's a swing to the beats. There's a bit of dream pop, I think. Actually, the label themselves say they like the Cocteau Twins, and that was one of the big inspirations. So there's so many different things, and they're just swirling around. And I think also that this track, Lindsay Lohan, you think about her current situation, and...
Do you think this is what it sounds like inside Lindsay Lohan's head?
Because it's a bit twisted. The music's just a bit twisted and ghostly, and I think it's, you know, it does tell her story better than her own music.
That's really interesting. Rosie, are you a fan of Witch House?
I'm a fan of Lindsay Lohan's music.
Are you?
I'm not, no.
I've never actually, I'm extremely pleased to say,
until this... cover was thrown my way, I'd never listened to a Lindsay Lohan song.
I would be really into it if this was a really dedicated cover. That's actually just basically the original sounded like that.
I can't say I like it on the level that I really want to listen to it, because the original is just about okay as a piece of vapid pop, but it just takes any sense of coherent melody and makes it quite an atonal piece of listening. So I don't...
Hey, but that's what Witch House is all about. Come on.
So I can't say I'm going to listen to it again. I don't hear enough of that, you know, any of the hook from the original or anything in there for it to keep me engaged. Sorry, Tim.
I'm not sure how I feel about it. I'm intrigued by what they're trying to do.
It's quite hard not to be, really. It's pretty weird.
They're doing lots of Lindsay.
So there's a compilation. It's free, actually, if you Google
free.
It.
Oh, free, it's
yeah,
free.
Yeah, so there's, I think there's six tracks, six wow. Lindsay Lohan covers, all by different Triangle artists.
Well, I mean, check it out. I said something different. I'm not sure when the moment would arise when I go, well, you know, I better put that on.
Mm.
The mood is right. You know.
I mean, I think it sounds like Metronomy as well, to a degree.
I don't think it's tuneful enough. I don't think it's got enough of it.
God, you want to hear the others?
This
was the big pop song for
me. So which house generally, for those of us who don't know, or those, I know, there's no us here, I know everything there is to know about which house. What are the sort of defining characteristics of it as a genre?
Well, I always used to think it was a very kind of slow, tuneless, bit of a dirge when I first
heard this song. Has totally changed my mind.
But I think there's the house element. I was speaking to Gareth Grundy about it from the Observer, and he was kind of talking about how a lot of the synth noises were very kind of uplifting, and they tapped into the sadness of the kind of a lot of the lyrics of early house. I think that's interesting. But I mean, it's all the slowed down beats and the chopped and screwed kind of element to it, which is
chopped and screwed indie take on house music. Is that what we're saying?
Pretty much. Excellent. Yeah.
Well, there you go. If that sounds like it might be up your strasse, the entire compilation of Lindsay Lohan cover versions is available at the website for DIS. That's DIS magazine, and it's from Triangle Records. Now let's listen to Rosie's selection. Too long. Yeah, far too long. I call my baby the Mambo Rider. I cry storms of tears to the rising of the dawn. And you know I'm only happy when I'm inside her. Yeah, and I guess that I've loved you far too long. Far too long. Far too long. That was Worm Tamer by Grindr. Nick Cave, of course, is a sort of side project. I think he'd say it wasn't a side project, it's just another band that he's in. That's from the album Grindr Man 2. Contains probably my favourite lyric of the year so far, which is, my baby calls me the Loch Ness Monster, two humps and then I'm gone. I love Grindr Man. I mean, I love Nick Cave and I love Grindr Man, and I think this album is great, and I particularly like this song. What was it about it, or this particular track, that drew you to bring it in?
I do love Grindr Man, and I didn't think that they could. I thought their signature song was No Pussy Blues, that's, you know, amazing. And that it represented everything that they were about until they did this song, and then they sort of done one better. You know, they come from the point of view of an aging rocker, and so they're half mocking themselves, and they're mocking the kind of rock misogyny that was you don't really get so much anymore, but was, you know, the casual sort of 70s rock misogyny.
And also, I think, you know, degree of misogyny prevalent in Nick Cave's, you know, work with the birthday parties. A lot of women.
So
stabbed
that's
in
the trouble, isn't it? When guys do, you know, come from this point of view, I always really like it because it kind of convinces me quite quickly that if they're able to articulate that feeling in themselves or in other men, then they must be above it. And perhaps it's not. I mean, perhaps none of this is done with any irony whatsoever.
Having met Nick Cave and Jim Sklavinov,
can assure us.
There's an enormous amount of you know, I've never met two human beings who kind of raise their eyebrows more, you know.
Exactly. I just think the very idea that, say, if you were to come from that rock misogyny point of view, the height, the biggest accolade you could give your wife or whoever you're in love with is that she had tamed your worm. She was the worm tamer.
Oh, brilliant. Tim, you're recently married. are you a Grindr Man fan?
Not as a rule, but I don't think I've given them quite enough of a chance, really. I've always been quite opposed to Nick Cave.
A lot of people are.
Wow, in what was?
I found him a bit of an alpha male, boorish kind of guy. I don't like people who have that kind of huge intellect but then get annoyed by anyone who, you know, feel like they're so superior to anyone who's maybe doesn't quite match up to that.
Yeah.
And I found it quite annoying. And then I heard this and saw the video to their last single.
The video is absolutely... If you haven't seen the video to the last Brandon Man single...
I think I've just got him completely wrong.
I think there's always been a lot of humour in his work that maybe it was easy to overlook because of the sort of slightly, you know, grim public persona that he had. And I think it's always... I think there's an element that's always meant to have been a bit funny, but this makes it really explicit.
I mean, do you think this is like a spoof? Do you find... Because I was thinking, to make a kind of... rock song with that much kind of
ridiculous
life to it.
My Mambo Rider. That
then to have those
thing.
Lyrics.
I think actually, you know, being a slightly older gentleman than you, Tim, I think that it actually does sort of articulate something about, you know...
when you had your worm tamed.
Well, no, I mean, it's about a sort of 40-something frustrated male mindset, you know what I mean? Of like having... Particularly if you've lived a life like Nick Cave, which with the best will in the world, you know, I mean, he really... you know, tore the arse out of it in his sort of teens and 20s and 30s. And if you've lived this life that was kind of heroin and debauchery and da-da-da-da-da, and find yourself, you know, with your... presumably with those urges kind of to a degree undimmed, living in Hove with your wife and two kids, it's probably all still there. And I think it's kind of an honest exploration of what it is to be a middle-aged man. And now it's my turn. the album Grinder Man 2 is out now. I urge you to go. I think it's a brilliant, brilliant album. I really like it. Now it's my turn. That was a Fuck You by CeeLo Green, also known as Forget You for obvious daytime Radio 1 playlist reasons. I picked this. It's become a kind of internet phenomenon. I'm not 100% certain why it's become an internet phenomenon, because one would have thought, we're living in 2010, you know, a song with some song with some swearing in it. You know what I mean? It's not that. But it is a good song. It's a really good Motown passage. He has a great, great voice, I think, CeeLo Green. Something kind of eerie and odd about his voice, you know, regardless of the context that it's in, whether he's working with Danger Mouse or whether... I don't know if you've heard the album he made before he started working with Danger Mouse called CeeLo Green as the Soul Machine. Absolutely, really, really good album made with people from Outkast and stuff like that. I just think it's sort of an... I think it's got Hit written through it like a stick of rock. I'm not sure it's coming out as a single. Rosie, what did you...
One of the things that I liked about Gnarls Barkley in the beginning was, other than, you know, the first time you heard Crazy, you just thought, well, you're really overwhelmed by the sound of it, was that lyrically there's been two themes to CeeLo's songwriting, one of which is, you know, being hurt by women, and the other is some quite serious attempts to tackle his mental health.
Issues, yes, absolutely.
And I felt like where Gnarls Barkley went wrong was that they got way too caught up in the sound that they'd created, and it started to sound like a pastiche.
Yeah, I actually agree.
Whilst forgetting that actually they had this amazing lyricist and vocalist there. So this song for me kind of treads the line to pastiche more than it does play to the elements of CeeLo that I have liked in the past.
You do sort of wonder, Tim, if this comes out as a single, you know, if it works in its edited radio version, because the gag is, presumably, you've got this kind of Motown, you know, sound with some guy swearing a lot over the top of it. You know, it's like an anachronistic thing. And there's a lot of anachronistic references in the track as well. You know, I Pity the Fool, obviously, A-Team reference and references to Xbox and things like that. Do you think it stands up as a song in its own right without swearing?
I think you'd be hard-pushed to say that's not a great pop song, really, isn't it? But I think, I mean, the only thing I'd say against it, I mean, it's good as a gimmicky pop record, but I just feel like it's not really CeeLo's fault. He obviously, you know, he's always been inspired by Motown. He has a history of that. But what have we had? We've had Pixie Lott, and we're down to Eliza Doolittle and Pixie Lott now. We started off with Winehouse, went through Plan B. I don't think it can be Plan Z now, aren't we?
Yeah. Which is like, man the lifeboats.
And I don't think it can be watered down much more. So when you hear a song that, you know, it's not like Hey Ya or something or Crazy, where it took a Motown sound and built on it, made it sound modern. It is pretty much
It is another Motown pastiche. There's definitely that. That is a... I hadn't thought about that, actually, because, you know, basically I do my best to kind of eradicate the thought of Pixie Lott's records from my brain. I had actually thought there is sort of records like Mamadou and stuff like that, isn't there, that have all plundered the same thing. I suppose it's post-Winehouse syndrome. Mm. Yeah.
And I just think he gets caught up in that, and it's not really, you know, I don't think he planned it. He's not jumping on the bandwagon.
No, not at all. No, I agree. It'd be interesting to see what the rest of the album's like, because one assumes it's not all like that. One assumes it isn't the, I was going to say the Passion of the Christ there, the Defamation of Strictly. I saw a great thing the other day. I misread a press release for James Blunt's new album, and I thought it said James Blunt's new album was called James Blunt Stays the Night, which is like the best name.
What is it called?
It's called something, the single is called Stay the Night. The album is called something, I don't know, All the Sad People or something. But what an amazing album, James Blunt Stays the Night. And I was thinking, well, you've got him on the front. He's like reclining on a sofa in a dressing gown, holding up a cocktail with a sort of, you know, cheeky, slightly goofy grin. Amazing. Give us a call, James, if your career needs a boost and I've got ideas. CeeLo Green's album, The Lady Killer, comes out in December. Interesting to see what the rest of it's like, at the very least, I think. Now, a few of your comments on last week's show. Remember, guardian.co.uk/musicweekly, or one word, is the place to leave them. On our Janelle Monáe feature, Phil Jones 87 writes, "My thing with Janelle Monáe, like a few others have said, is that she seems so in control, self-confident and unflappable that she does actually come across a bit androidy. Everything is so measured and the image carefully considered that it's hard to really love her." Fair point. Could have said the same thing about David Bowie, couldn't you, in sort of 1975? Because obviously in 1975, you wouldn't have known that he was actually completely out of his mind and living off cocaine and peppers and storing his own wee in the fridge. And not for a minute, that's just that Janelle Monáe is storing her own wee in the fridge. But Monardo says, "Why is there a need to feel like an artist would be your pal in order to love their work? It is a fantasy, part of the packaging. Meet a few rock stars or poets or actors and you'll be cured of it." You certainly will. Yeah. The desire to have rock stars be your chum.
It's not that, though. It's not wanting to be pals with them. It's wanting to be let in a bit, isn't it?
I guess so, yeah.
Just to get a bit of heart.
Yeah, I suppose so, yes. Besides, lots of serious entertainers are extremely guarded because they want their work to be what speaks for them, not their answers to journos whose agendas may or may not be similar to theirs. Interesting. On the subject of Fugazi, a couple of you mentioned the band Q and Not You with Pete 4851983, which sounds like the name of a hardcore band, saying, "No Kill Beat Beat by Q and Not You seems to really embody a proper Discord sound in a way that a lot of the later Discord output maybe didn't." Discord, for those of you who didn't hear the Fugazi feature, is the label that Fugazi and Ian McKay started. I think Ian and Jeff, presumably means Ian McKay and Jeff from Fugazi, have even said that Q and Not Q restored their faith in releasing DC music when it had been on the wane for some time. Thanks very much for feedback, everybody. Please keep it coming. And now it's time for your label showing, the feature in which we ask label head honchos to tell us a little bit about their imprint. Nadia Dalawi and Sarah Jade are the minds behind Young and Lost, the label which brought us Larrick in Love, Noah and the Whale, Good Shoes, Vincent and the Villains, among others, and Jolene and the Jing Jang Jong too. God bless them. Here's their story.
We met each other at boarding school when we were 12, and we didn't really have much else to do, and we just started getting into really old bands. Like, first it was like 60s bands and then like 70s bands, especially like the New York punk scene of like 77, like Patti Smith and Television and the Ramones. And we started doing a fanzine.
And then we started doing a club night to go over fanzine and then learn to DJ. And then we moved to London to go to university and we dropped out after a year, and that's when we decided to set up Young and Lost Club. And our first single was with Vincent and the Villains, and it was Blue Boy. It's much harder than you thought to find true love in this town, so full of ambition. But you struggle under the weight of your inhibition. We really loved the band, and they used to play our club a lot, and they just sounded different to everyone else, and they had a really strong aesthetic, like with their artwork and how they looked and presented themselves. And they were the ones that, when we told them we were thinking about starting a label, they said, "If you do it, we really want to be your first release." So it was a good incentive.
The single sold out in about a month, but it was about 3 months late because we used this pressing plant in Czechoslovakia and they didn't speak English. But it was the cheapest place we could find. And it was 3 months later, we already had so many shop orders, so it sold out very quickly.
There was a lot of anticipation because it was so late.
It was a real learning curve.
Yeah.
the beginning, we didn't have a clue. Looking back, especially now, after everything we know, we really didn't have a clue. We just learned as we went along.
I think if we had actually known in advance how much work it was going to be and how involved it would be, we might never have set up the label. But we had no idea what we were doing or what we were getting into, so we just kind of went ahead with it.
The Vincent Minson Villains single, the first one we did with them, I think because it was our first single, it was always really memorable. And also 5 years' time with Noah Mawell. It was our first time working long-term with a band, and everyone was so excited about the single, and it really took off.
With the fanzine, because we did that when we were at school, there are quite a few funny stories of meeting people in like the music scene for the first time, because we used to go to gigs, sneak out of boarding school to go to gigs in London, and then we always had to get the last train home, so we'd have to leave halfway through a show. And we were at a Moldy Peaches gig at Yulu, and we were really trying to get out on time to get back to school before we got found out. And Pete Doherty was there, and he really liked the fanzine, and he introduced us to Johnny Burrell. And then we were like, oh, really nice to meet you, chat a bit. And we're like, oh, we have to go. And they were like, oh, where are you girls going? And we were like, to a party? And they're like, can we come? And we were like, no, definitely not. And then just legged it back to school.
As girls, we've always felt quite accepted. I think because we'd been around for so long doing the fanzine and doing club nights.
Everyone was just used to us.
And there are perks of being girls as well. But definitely sometimes it seems like a boys' club. But more with the DJ club night side?
The financial side of things were really difficult when we first started. We used to DJ for like 6 to 8 hours in a row just to earn money to put singles out, which was quite hard work.
We're putting out an album with O Minnows this year. And
he used to be in Semi-Finalists, who we did a single with.
And we had done an EP with O Minnows before, but this will be his first album. And we're really excited about the Planet Earth album, which Charlie Fink's going to record.
And there's the Noah and the Whale third album out in March.
I'd be waiting to last night's sunset set the world to light. I sent you this message. Where are you? Are you alright?
Wow, Young and Lost there. Quite an intriguing. You're not pretending to be anything they're not, are they, the ladies behind Young and Lost?
What do you mean?
I mean, you know, in that if you were a couple of obviously quite posh girls from a boarding school, you might attempt to make up some kind of backstory or whatever to, you know what I mean?
Right, okay. Well,
make yourself appear more rock and roll, but they're not doing that, and fair play to them.
That story is extremely sweet, though, the idea of two people who've loved indie music from such a young age. We used to sneak out of school together. You know, they used to kind of climb in through windows and stuff to get back from gigs. I don't know, I just think that's brilliant. And they're always at shows. Whenever I was at shows, every little indie band I saw while I was at NME, all through the kind of the noughties, you'd always guarantee that they'd be there. They just seem to go to every indie show.
So, is there an aesthetic, Tim? Do you think to the records that Young and Lost Club put out?
I think so, definitely. It's always a very DIY sound, quite a kind of confused young men, skinny young men, trying to make pop songs with guitars and sounding a bit weedy, but tuneful at the same time.
Yeah.
And it's almost like the story that went alongside that kind of revival of indie music. You know, a lot of the bands didn't make it, like Larrick in Love and, you know, Jolene and stuff like that. Mm. But at the same time, it was a story that a lot of people followed.
This is the kind of, when you say that revival of indie music, you're talking about the sort of post-Libertines.
Yeah, I'm talking about the Libertines and Razorlight and the Strokes, just all the kind of big bands who made it, who actually had you know, a big sound, and you can tell why they made it. And bands like Good Shoes, they wrote good pop songs, but they were never going to be massive. And I thought it was good that there was kind of a little label set up by two girls who genuinely loved this music, were, you know, given a platform for these little records. And I think, as you know, if you get the compilation, you realise that a lot of them were great songs. Really,
it's interesting, isn't it? You talk about sort of the bands that didn't really make it, they're on that label, and you know, said a few of them signed to major labels, you know, subsequently signed to major labels. But what's interesting, I think, about Young and Lost Club is they've got Noah and the Whale, who have done pretty well, really. And they're still on Young and Lost Club. They haven't, like, been snatched up by a major label. I'm sure a major label have offered them a deal at some point, and they've chosen to stick with it. Which is really interesting that even in this day and age where you sort of think really indie labels can't achieve anything other than putting, like, one single out by a band that then goes and signs to Universal, they're doing pretty well.
And actually, these are the little labels that are probably going to survive when the death of the industry finally arrives. It's going to be that these aren't unsustainable businesses.
No. Clearly, you've got a way of producing records on a budget, and you know that keys into the sound of the records itself. You know, I mean, I'm sure that some of these bands don't want to sound. You know what I mean? You say sort of windy. No one wants to sound windy.
They were actually signed to Young and Lost.
You know, I'm sure that given the budget, they would make a rather different sounding record. But you know, the finance is key into the way the sort of sonic aesthetic.
So, yeah. As Jolene would have said.
Yeah. Well, there you go. But I mean, you know, they've had other successes. We're back to Noah and the Whale again. I saw Good Shoes Live. I thought, oh, fucking crap. But I will say this. I looked around at the audience and I thought, wow, you look amazing. All the kids were like, looked absolutely. And I was like, wow, where are all these, like, when I used to go an indie gig in the 80s,
it was, I know,
all
like, ooh. When did kids get so fashionable?
All the blokes were really sharp and all the girls looked really hot. And it was like, this is amazing. This is totally different from the indie music I remember as a youth. There is a compilation album of stuff on the Young and Lost label, if you feel inspired by the two fast-talking young ladies that ran the label, or still do run the label. So, yeah, go out and get that if that is your bag. Well, that's all for this week's podcast. Cheers, Tim. Thank you for coming in.
It's been an absolute delight.
It is a delight, actually, isn't it? I hope some of the love that we feel towards each other on this podcast, you know, translates into the programme itself. Rosie, always a pleasure, never a chore, of course.
Exactly the same for me. The same sentiment for me.
Thanks to our producer, Elisha, who's depping for our usual producer beat. I'm Alexis Petridis. I'll see you next time.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.